News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on KMJ. Whether you're listening on the AM, the FM, or online at KMJnow.com, you know that each week we visit with World War II veterans. We want to honor them for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories for posterity. And along the way, learn a thing or two about what it means to love our country. Learn about the price that's been paid for that freedom that we enjoy every day. Last week, we talked about the film Red Tails. And this week, we're going to hear about another film, Flag of My Father. Now, don't confuse that with Clint Eastwood's movie based on John Bradley's book about Iwo Jima. This is a different film. I don't think you've heard about it. If you live in northern Louisiana, maybe you have, and that's where I was this past week with the Bulldogs, and we're going to pick up the story here in Monroe, Louisiana. I'm joined by Rodney Ray, who's a veteran and also a filmmaker, and Flag of My Father. Give us the nutshell of where this idea came from and what it's all about.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your show today. You know, the film started when I actually attended the funeral of a World War II veteran, and his son and I were friends. And at the gravesite, when they were about to lower the casket in, they presented the flag to the family. And he had something in common with me, and that is that his mom had already passed away. And so he and his brother were the survivors of his dad. And so it was his brother, and they both had two sons. And when the honor guard turned to present the flag to the family, he didn't know who to give it to. And so he just held the flag out. It was a beautiful thing to see if you'd ever watched it in person. But six sets of hands reached for that flag. All six hands had their hands on that flag because they all wanted it, which was the way it should be. And I realized sitting there watching that, that was going to play out in my life one day, because as the son of a veteran, my dad's 89, a World War II veteran, and still in good health, but one day, and my mom has already passed away, and I have, it's me and my brother and my sister, the issue is that I'm the youngest, so what's the odds of the youngest getting the flag, right? But I did share a bond with my dad that I think is special, and that's that he and I are both veterans. And I realized at that point that it was going to play out in my life, and I needed to speak to my family about it and how we should handle it when it came about. And thus, as a filmmaker, you know, I just caught the essence of a great scene for a movie, a great idea for a movie. So we spun Flag of My Father, the whole story around that moment.
Did you have any idea when you got that idea and you started running with it that it could turn into winning the top prize at the GI Film Festival and going around the world in DVD sales and telling the story that it's been able to tell?
Well, I wish I could say yes, but yeah. But no, you know, you have high hopes for your films and stuff, but, you know, it was just an idea. It was a very passionate idea for me. And what was really cool, Paul, about the whole story was when we wrote the script, and I write my stuff and I collaborate with writers. So the writer that came in and helped me with it, you know, have you ever seen the commercial where the couple walks in and sets the faucet down and says, build a house around this? That's kind of the way the movie was, you know, build a movie around this scene and some other things I wanted to say to the film. And the writer and I started working. I actually worked with two different writers. But once we got it all set, I thought it was a great scene, a movie. And when we sent it out, one of the lead actors is William Devane.
William Devane, a veteran actor, instantly recognizable face from his years on Knott's Landing, but he's been in so many films and programs over the years. By the way, I have a trailer for this film, Flag of My Father, on our website, kmjnow.com. But Rodney, you're getting to William Devane's thoughts on this script for this film.
What Bill has said about the script is it's the best script he's ever worked on. And then John Snyder's in it as well, and both these guys love the script. And John's comment is when he got through shooting, he thought he gave his best performance of any movie he's ever been in. And I believe that's true. John delivers a just stellar performance, and so does Bill. So everybody that saw the script loved it, and it did kind of take off bigger than we expected it to.
And for people that aren't instantly recognizing that name, John Schneider, all I have to say is Bo on the Dukes of Hazzard, right?
That's it, Bo on the Dukes of Hazzard, and he's involved in a lot of other things. You'd be shocked, and once you put it all together, you're, there's John, and he's a very talented actor.
So this movie, Flag of My Father, and you can find it at r2films.com or r2films.net if you want to order it online. Give us a sense, without giving away the movie, because we want people to watch it, of what the plot is, where it revolves, and what you hope that people watching it are going to get and remember and hold on to after experiencing the film.
Well, I've often described the movie as a diamond. It's multifaceted. So if you're if you come from a blended family, then you're gonna take away something from it. If you're a veteran, you're gonna take something away from it. If your parent is a veteran, you're gonna take something away from it. You know, we're a faith-based company, so if faith is important, you're gonna bring that away from it. So it just depends on where you. If you're patriotic, I mean, it's some huge, just wonderful patriotic moments in the film. So depending on who you are, what you take away from it, but the story is basically about a lady who is the youngest in the family, and she also happens to be the half sister of the other brothers. Now that's no parallel in my family. My brothers or my and sister are my full brother and sister, but that she's a veteran and she serves in Iraq, and she gets taken as a POW. And then her experiences while she's there, and to regain her freedom. Now I start spoiling the movie if I went any further. But that's the nutshell what happens. And the struggle with the brothers to respect her for her service, because they just have issues with her, not because she's female, not because she's a soldier, but because she's a half-sister, and Dad seems to love her the most.
Being a veteran yourself and the son of a veteran, I would imagine that this was an emotional project for you. How much of your own experiences and what you've gleaned from your dad's experiences do you think kind of through osmosis got into the film?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of that. You know, if you're when you're the writer and the director, and you try to put so much of what the message you want to say, and you try to keep your personal life out of the film as much as you can, but it is who you are, your essence, and the message you're trying to speak. I've had people, when we actually first release a script to some the bigger distribution companies, that read the script and said, "This script is no good. You need to have it totally rewritten." And then those same people, when they saw the film, loved it. So, you know, that's the way movie scripts are, is you can read them until it comes alive on screen. And that was true with us too. We thought the film was good, but once we saw the final product, we were even shocked at how good it all came together. And that's just the way film is. You know, like you mentioned earlier, we won the GI Film Festival this in 2011. That's the largest military film festival in the world, and we were so honored to do that, to be able to go up there, and especially as a faith-based film, to win a secular event like that. And so it was very honoring. You know, the response from the audience there was overwhelming, and the actors, even beyond the big stars, John and Bill. You know, you've got Gigi Arnetta, who's out of New York City area, who did a wonderful job with the lead role. Andrew Sesnick, some people may have seen him in some of the roles he's done, did an outstanding job as the oldest brother. And just everybody came together to make it come to make a complete film. But, yeah, it's a lot of me in there, but you'd have to know me personally to say, yeah, there's a reflection of Rodney.
Well, and one thing that you did once the film was out, you had something here in Monroe where you made an official dedication to your dad. Tell me about that and why that was important to you.
Well, you know, like I said earlier, my mom passed away, about 5 or 6 years ago now. And my mom was my biggest inspiration in my life. She's my biggest hero, like everybody. You know, she's my biggest cheerleader. And but this film was just so much connected to me and my dad. And in the closing, as the movie ends and before the credits roll, you know, there's a little statement that comes up, and it says, "For you, Dad," because I owe so much of who I am and what I am to my dad, from my upbringing to my training. You know, my real profession, other than filmmakers, is a registered land surveyor. And so I have a large surveying business that allows me to fund my own movies. But I learned that because that's what my dad is. He's a professional engineer and a land surveyor. I often tell people, you know, Jesus was a carpenter because his dad was a carpenter, and I'm a land surveyor because my dad was a land surveyor. So, but, you know, he and I have a special bond. Our favorite, one of our favorite things every year is the Army-Navy game. You know, he was in the Army and I was in the Navy. Of course, we romped on him pretty good for the last, about time for them to get one on us. But just kind of a special bond that we share is being veterans. And some of it's just unspoken. You know, it's just that, it's just, and veterans know. You know, it's just like players on a team. You know, it's just something you share.
Well, not to get melodramatic, but folks who listen to this show regularly know that we often talk about the what ifs. What if a veteran had a little different experience during World War II? And in your case, would you even be here? Would this film exist if your dad hadn't made it back from World War II?
Yeah, right. And that's something to really ponder on. And he had many close calls. It's during his service in the South Pacific. You know, when I did, we did another thing called, we call them Heroes. It's about Vietnam veterans. And one of the things that I noticed that those veterans struggle with the most is why me. You know, why me did I come home and not my best friend? And, you know, they would tell stories of where they saw their best friend die right next to them or took their position that day. You know, let me do this today. Do you mind? Oh, go ahead. And they die. And they have a hard time reconciling their mind. Why me? But, you know, we can't answer all those questions. And I'm just thankful to God that my dad did come home safe.
As we talk about veterans and what it means to serve, was there anything about your dad's story or as you grew up hearing his story that maybe inspired you, whether you chose to serve or not, but inspired you in the time that you spent in the military?
Well, I think it's, you know, there's always a level of pride for your, when you know, your dad or any of your relatives to serve in the military. And just, I grew up listening to him tell the stories, you know, over and over and over, and he still, you know, tells them today and just listening to them. And, yeah, you know, one thing that when I go, I speak a lot about FIMS and stuff, but no matter what group I speak to, there's one thing they all have in common, and that is they all say the pledge to our flag. And that's kind of what the movie's about, is that when that flag, when it waves in the air, when it flies, it does something to you. It stirs something in you. So when you're listening to your father tell about his experiences back in the 40s and, you know, in a war that, you know, that meant so much to the history of our country, yeah, it'll change you.
The movie is Flag of My Father. We're going to hear from Rodney's father in just a moment. You might want to check out his new film also, New Hope, that's debuting soon. That website again, r2films.com or r2films.net. That link is on our Hometown Heroes page at kmjnow.com. And how about this? Film trailers are meant to be seen and heard, not just heard, but I think you might still get a feel for the emotion of this movie by listening to a bit of the trailer right now. So let's do that. Flag of My Father. Here you go.
Why'd you go to the war?
Sometimes the good people have to stand up against the bad people. And you go off and fight for what you believe in.
No matter what, rescue, death, I wasn't alone.
I never knew that you were at Da Nang.
Well, it's not that I didn't want to tell you, it's just, you know.
She told you, Judy?
Yes, but that's just because.
That's because you're his favorite.
I remember hearing a fellow once say that of all the soldiers that go into combat, the ones with the toughest job are the nurses.
Well, every war has its heroes.
They certainly do, and I'm dancing with one.
It's my father's flag. I feel like it's the only connection I have to my dad left.
Please don't tell me that you are so thick that you don't understand that.
So you can hear some of the emotional drama that unfolds in Flag of My Father. I've seen the film. I can tell you it has some very moving moments. It also does a good job, without getting too sidetracked, of touching on the very real issue of PTSD and how it affects our returning veterans today. I think if you enjoy Hometown Heroes and the kind of things that we discuss here, you will definitely appreciate this film as well. It's available on DVD, and if there's enough interest here in the Valley, maybe we can set up a special viewing in a local theater. Stay tuned for that. The movie is Flag of My Father. We're going to hear from Rodney's father in just a moment. You might want to check out his new film also, New Hope, that's debuting soon. That website again, r2films.com or r2films.net. Anything else you want to share with our listeners about what you do and why you do it?
Well, you mentioned New Hope, which is our newest film that deals with teen issues, including teen suicide. You know, we've had some issues here locally with some of our teens, and we're just, you know, our company motto is to make life-changing films, and I think the title of New Hope kind of sums it all up. We want to give people hope, especially our teenagers. I think if you're a parent out there and, you know, your teen needs to see this film, it's that powerful. It hadn't been released yet. Should be here shortly, but you can go to our website, like you said, keep an eye on it.
We will certainly be doing that. Rodney Ray, Navy veteran, son of an Army veteran. They're both Louisiana Tech grads, but you fans of the Real Bulldogs of Fresno State can forgive them for that, I hope. Rodney, I just want to say thank you for what you're doing to honor veterans, to bring their experiences to light, and thank you for your own service to our country as well.
Thank you very much.
All right, we've heard from the filmmaker. Now we'll hear from his inspiration. Rodney's dad actually found his way into the film as an extra, but none of this would have ever occurred if he hadn't survived some pretty intense experiences with the 38th Infantry Division. That's the division General Douglas MacArthur dubbed the Avengers of Bataan for their important work in the Philippines in World War II. 89-year-old Asa Ray joins us when we continue right after I share a few words about one of our proud supporters of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ.
It's as simple as ABC, friends, no tea.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 to the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. For the second week in a row here, we're talking about films, and I hope you will take the time, just as you saw Red Tails, to take a look at Flag of My Father. You're not going to see it in the theaters, but it's out on DVD now. It's already been down that road on the big screen, was the winner of the GI Film Festival last year. Flag of My Father has been dedicated to the man we're going to talk to now, Asa Ray, 89 years old. He's originally from Columbia, Louisiana, and that's still in the northern part of the state, I suppose. What was it like there in December of 1941, and do you remember how you found out that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
Yes, I was working for the quartermaster at Camp Polk at the time, and I remember it. When I heard it, it was unbelievable. And it had an effect on all of people. In those days, we began to hate Japanese because they were going to be an enemy. They had struck without warning. And Navy ships were sunk in Pearl Harbor, and you can see the ruins of today. It affected our lives. Remember, Pearl Harbor was the words that you would hear people speak of. And I was 20 years old when they dropped the draft down below 21, and they drafted me in. I went in as a infantryman, field artillery training, 105 howitzers.
That's a big, loud gun.
Yes. At Fort Bragg was where we trained. The training was rigid for a country boy. It was furthest away from home I'd been ever been, and trained in a lot of things, judo, how to operate major vehicles up to Big Macs. So we'd be ready when we got to combat. The obstacle courses that they put us through were new to me, but being small, I was able to keep up with the activities. I met a lot of people from New York City and Pennsylvania and in the Northeast port. I had a lot of friends. It was very familiar with the different languages, and I enjoyed the knowledge that I learned. They had kid me about, you've never been on a subway. I say, well, you've never been possum hunting.
How many possums had you bagged by then?
Plenty of them. The possum doesn't climb a very tall tree, and you can bend it over a lot of times and get him out. If you had a good dog, you'd chase him up a tree.
They probably didn't even know what a possum was.
Oh, no. But you got to experience the nightlife to enjoy it. And the river hills near Columbia was something, valleys running into the river, and we hunted along that area. Coons and possums were the main games. During the Depression days, there was a lot of people that trapped for a living. It was well-paying for fur, mink, and coons and possum. They would come from Monroe down to Columbia and see what furs we had ready for them. So it was enjoyable. I sold rabbits to Monroe residents. You had to leave 1 foot on, make sure it wasn't a dog or cat. And we'd go, and I was taught how to dress them and bring them here. And we would shop in Monroe and would sell the rabbits around for income. As a kid, I was doing pretty good.
Hunting rabbits and possums and stuff like that is a far cry from a 105 howitzer. So you're playing with a little bigger firepower now, huh?
Oh, yes. The 105 howitzer is a great gun, and it would shoot pretty rapid. Those guys that were killing arrows, they could load it on a recoil. And at Zigzag Pass, it was a place we invaded, they could shoot that thing when we were under attack, and they could really keep it going. The death toll began to go because we ran into some well-trained Japanese Marines in Luzon, one of the islands in the Philippines, and the lieutenant came by and tapped me on the shoulder. My best buddy had been killed. He said, you are now forward observer. And that's the way you started.
This was with the 38th Infantry Division in the Philippines in late 1944 and into 1945. Some pretty intense combat going on.
Well, you don't think you're going to make it, but I was grateful. I'm only here today, but by the grace of God. I was called into a place where the action, your life span is very short.
Your son mentioned that you had a lot of close calls, and you just alluded to that a little bit. What did you think? Were you, I mean, you're still a kid. You're 20, 21 years old. You're half a world away from Louisiana. What made you think that you might be able to survive this? And how often did you think, you know what, this could be my day?
Well, I believe in Jesus and Lord. And I felt like they were always with me because some of the actions that I went through, it just doesn't seem possible that I'd be alive.
I want to hear about that. This is with the 38th Infantry Division. You're in the field artillery as a forward observer, which means you're trying to find the high ground to observe the enemy position so you can direct that artillery fire, right?
Well, the infantry would have a hold in the hill they was trying to take in Luzon, and we'd go up and support an officer, and I would go up with a radio sergeant, and I was a corporal, which was a non-com, and I had to be in charge. And many times I directed fire. I felt like that I saved a lot of lives in doing so.
By taking out enemy positions that would have killed infantry?
Yes. For instance, they would send a scout out. Now, the Japanese were all around us, and they attacked the positions where we were. And the foxholes in the infantry had places where they had dug in, and we'd get next to the commander of the infantry. So for communications, we had radio, and it was ABC company, red, white, and blue, and we were white. Mainly, we had points that we would just hit in the daytime with binoculars and peeping out over the head, keeping snipers from killing us. Artillery was like 3 to 5 miles behind the front lines. We'd be at the front lines, and the Japanese would be all around us. We was north of Clark's Field there in the Philippines.
Clark Field, of course, the American air base north of Manila that was overrun by Japanese forces not long after Pearl Harbor, and it wasn't retaken by American forces until January of 1945, which is about the time period we're talking about here.
And there was all kinds of Japanese officers in different military that when the invasion of MacArthur came back. I was at Luzon, too, when we came in at Corregidor. MacArthur was in a B-25 flying over that day, according to the radio that I heard. I could get the shortwave radio back to San Francisco and listen to what was going on over my head. At Corregidor, when we hit the mainland, I was on with an LCI. That was an infantry vessel.
Landing Craft Infantry, LCI.
I was the only artilleryman aboard. We had Navy that could direct fire, and I could direct fire for the artillery. But when we came in view of the land, the Japanese were on top of Corregidor. They had captured the guns when MacArthur said, "I shall return."
And so many Americans were captured and sent on the Bataan Death March.
Yes, and a shell fell pretty close to the LCI, and I didn't have an officer to tell me to come below. I thought, well, a shell like that hits this little vessel, we're all gone. So I'm just stood up there, and all of a sudden, the warships out of sight was shooting the Navy. They set the world on fire on the trees. They shot through them. I saw them after I got on land, where that they'd shoot through trees, you know, 12, 14 inches in diameter. But I was going to tell you, Japanese, they had captured Corregidor, and it's islands separated from the land. But when we got on land, I could see the helmets and where the death march started. It had been years, but you'd see where they'd dropped things on the ground and left them. And that's where the death march started. Our infantry division, and we were artillery support. We'd go forward with the company like K and A and F, that's rifle, and they're up next to the enemy, and we would go up there. Oh, there was just many times that the Japanese just couldn't hit me. It's the grace of God. I knew it sounds like it impossible. As close as you are sitting to me, I'd had grenades hit on the opposite side of you there, and that guy'd be gone, and I wouldn't get a scratch. I never did bleed unless it was a minor thing. It would be like a grace blade cut me. I wouldn't take a Purple Heart for that, because there would be people dying and bleeding. The greatest heroes are the ones that didn't come back. I remember a sergeant, his dad was a judge, and a bouncing Betty got him. He just walking along, he stepped on that thing and popped up. And the infantry captain would call on artillerymen, it would be the 3 or 4 of us, to help. At nighttime, when the Japs came, they'd stalk in the dark and throw grenades and shoot. And there was an infantryman from Tennessee. He wanted to give me his name of his girlfriend. He had been wounded once. He wanted me to call his mother and father, and I said, "Oh, you gonna make it?" Well, the next day, during daylight, he was out on a patrol. I was with a lieutenant who had never been up there before, and they told us we had to go up on the side of a hill to observe. And he was scared to death. It was his first trip up there. He's a good man, good officer. And we went up there, and it's just a 6x8 hole that was sandbags around it. It was shallow. We jumped in there, and bullets began to knock the sand out of the sandbags. And he saw me stick my head up, and he said, "Will they kill you?" He was lying flat down in the bottom of that foxhole. I said, "No, sir. You know they have bolt action gun. And when he shoots, right after I see that sand, I'll peep up and get a..."
Hey, you wanted to get a look at where everything was, enemy and friendly.
Now, don't forget Tennessee. He was out with his scout, and the unit got pinned down, and they was begging for artillery to get out of there. And I had experience as a surveyor before I went to engineering. I could read the quadrangle, and I could look at that hill, and that's what I wanted to see, because I could hear the report, and I knew the way they went out on patrol, and I memorized in my mind just where I thought they'd be. That was a place that we'd call for a concentration number during the daylight hours, and I directed it in reference to that point that I knew. But the Lord was with me, because I was doing a lot of guesswork. The officer there, I could hear him talking on the radio. He says, "We're surrounded, and if we don't get help soon, we won't get back to the unit." I thought of Tennessee, the guy that we went up to help, because there was a foxhole there, and he says, "I'll sleep up on top, because if Jap comes, he's going to throw the grenade in the hole with you guys, two of us." And I remembered him. When I went back to the concentration, well, with the help of the Lord, the first two rounds, we shoot two rounds for effect, and we'll adjust. I could hear him on the radio. He says, "That's just ahead of us." I said, "Well, sir, if I bring it back, you may get you." He said, "We gonna be got anyhow." And I brought it back 50 yards, and he said, "Well, that's right at us, close." And said, "We could get up, run now." And Tennessee didn't make it back. It's difficult to think about that. There was a lot of brave men like that that didn't come back.
Well, I'm grateful the brave man talking to us did come back. If he didn't, that film, Flag of My Father, wouldn't exist. And if you didn't get it earlier, this is not a World War II film. It's actually set in current times, involving an Iraq War veteran and her Vietnam veteran father. It was inspired by World War II vets. And without confusing you here, the bottom line about Flag of My Father is it's the kind of film that can bring veterans of all eras, not to mention the rest of us, all together to realize what it really means to love our country. Love it enough to be willing to die for that flag and what it represents. Speaking of heroes, tonight is Heroes Night at the Save Mart Center. Fresno State is playing Utah State in basketball, but all active military, all veterans, in addition to firefighters, paramedics, and law enforcement officers, can get tickets for themselves and their families, their groups, for just $5 a head. It's going to be a very special night. My friend Henry LeMay, an 80-year-old Korean War veteran, is going to be singing the national anthem. He is tremendous. We'll have a special presentation at halftime, too, with Chief Jerry Dyer of the Fresno Police Department. So I hope you'll come out tonight for Heroes Night at the Save Mart Center. The tip-off's at 7 o'clock. Get there early, though. And don't go anywhere. More from 89-year-old Asa Ray after I tell you a little bit more about our supporters of this program, like Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course, the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'll be back with a veteran from the San Joaquin Valley next week, but when I travel around the country to announce Bulldog games, it is such a pleasure to meet veterans wherever I go, and it reminds me that no matter where you go in our United States, no matter how big or small your hometown might be, there are heroes there who have done a lot more than we realize to preserve our freedom and our way of life. That's why I call the show Hometown Heroes, and in the case of 89-year-old Asa Ray, he grew up in Columbia, Louisiana, population 477. When we left off, he was talking about his experiences as a forward observer, an artilleryman with the 38th Infantry Division in the Philippines. That's a division that helped retake so much ground the Japanese had captured early in the war. And, you know, I've always wondered how people in your position could ever sleep because the dark brought on so much uncertainty, and your enemy was very, very active at night.
I'll tell you this. We were subject to a big, heavy mortars. They said the foxholes that it dug was as deep as this tabletop. I was in one by myself. The Japanese were all around this shooting and carrying on. The captain would usually say, just knives only, but when those Japs come, it'd be all kind of shooting. It was dark, and suddenly I heard something bump, bump, bump coming toward my foxhole, and I was in there by myself. And it fell to the bottom by my side. And I thought, well, that's a grenade. I'm going to sacrifice my legs. And I turned towards the side of I was being almost against it. It didn't go off. I said, it's a dud. And I started feeling, gradually moving my hand down toward my on the bottom of the foxhole. I finally found it. Can of beans. And I was telling the secretary that one time, and she said, well, it may have been a can of beans when you found it, but it's the Lord may have had something to do with that. You know, why would anyone throw a can of beans at you? But I could hear it bumping there a few bumps before it hit the bottom. That's just one scene that I went through. I was glad to feel that can of beans, though.
Best can of beans you ever had. It sure sounds like it must have been impossible to try to get any sleep on any night, not knowing when you could be attacked, whether it was even safe to sleep. How did you deal with that?
Well, some of the guys would fall asleep, but the one thing you didn't want to ever do, don't touch a combat soldier to wake him up. Just whisper his name. He'll answer you.
What happened if you touched him?
Well, he may bayonet you. He's had a bayonet ready, and that was what way we were trained. One time, as a tank came up, one of those open top tanks came up to give us support. The guy jumped out of that tank, and we'd been trying to take that hill, and we'd been pushed back a couple of times. I had a little carbine rifle. It had a short bayonet on it. Well, I lost my cool. I fixed my bayonet when that guy jumped out of there. He was running over there. He's going to jump over the ridge and kill some Japs, I guess. I lost my cool and I started running after him. Well, Jap threw a grenade over and killed him. He was about 6-8 feet ahead of me. Didn't touch me. But I changed my mind about taking them Japs. I went back to my foxhole. That's just some of the things you'll do. You get brave, you get wet with sweat, and just shake. You go brave, and then you get scared, and you come to your senses. And they work on your nerves, and the kind of warfare this was in the Philippines. Well, I'll tell you one thing. It's terrible on your nerves.
How long were you there in the Philippines?
From January of 43, I went into the Army. Around November, of 45, I was out. So we had 200 days. I remember a bulletin. The 38th Division had been under continuous warfare for 200 days. That was a record.
To me, I try to put myself in your shoes, and I think of the uncertainty you must have felt. First of all, not knowing if you're ever going to make it home, and second of all, not knowing if this war is ever going to end. Did those thoughts occur to you? And if so, how did you process that? How did you deal with that?
We listened to the news. You didn't think strongly that you'd be alive when daylight come. I didn't feel like I was going to get home. But yet, I felt like the faith I had in the Lord, I would be home.
You must have still been there overseas when the war came to an end. How did you find out that Japan had surrendered and that you would be able to get home?
Well, now you're going to hear something there that was really happening. The planes was coming overhead. We were at Manila. We'd been pulled back out of combat, and we were grouping to go to make an invasion in Tokyo when the war was over. I had a shortwave radio on, listening in San Francisco. They said the peace treaty is now flying over Manila. And I looked up there and I said, that plane is drowning me out. And I knew the direction of the airport. I said, that's them. It has to be the party. And that's the way I found out. And the guns went off that night, and I was making myself scarce because I didn't want to get killed by soldiers. They just shooting anyway. It sounded like popcorn to popping. And the ships were blowing the whistle. Car horns, what you round, you couldn't hear anything.
People were all celebrating whatever way they could, huh?
Yes, and I didn't know if we made that invasion, our chances of getting on bank were not very good.
If you had had to invade Japan itself.
That's right.
And I know you're glad you didn't. I'm glad you didn't, too, because you're here talking to me. And your son, Rodney, would have never been born. He went on to serve our country, and now he's made this film, Flag of My Father, dedicated it to you. What did that mean to you? Can you describe for us what that was like to see this film and then to realize that you were a major inspiration for that passion of his?
Well, I just praise the Lord that he sees that, and I think it's wonderful that he's done that. And he's to be complimented on his ability. He was, as a child growing up, he always had questions I couldn't answer. What's keeping the moon up there from falling and stuff like that. And being an engineer later on, well, I didn't know at the time he was asking these questions anything about the earth is circling the sun. And all that going on, it takes more than I know to even think about it.
I get the sense, as thankful as you are that you made it home from the war when so many didn't, more than 400,000 Americans died in World War II, it seems that it did take a toll on you. Can you put that into words, what you've had to live with since the war?
Yes, I can. I had a dream, and I dreamed it two or three times long at the time I was coming home. I dreamed that I went over to the Japanese. They had tunnels that they dig into the side of the ground, and I caught one of them, and they were small people usually, and I had him down and choking him. I said, let's call this silly war off. Well, I was just shaking him. Well, when I woke up, I kept... that dream stayed with me. I was afraid when I married, I was afraid I would wake up dream and choke my wife to death. I thought about handcuffing my hands to the bed's head. I said, oh, that wouldn't work. I dreamed that same dream, and finally it went away. But I'd have dreams of scenes like I could smell that mess. The movies don't have odors to see, but flies, the only way you could eat those rations up there were dead bodies, or you know the flies was coming from dead bodies, was to use that like a cowboy's mask.
A bandana over your face, huh?
Yeah. You had to knock the flies away to eat rations. You see, we ran out of water one time, and I want to live by a river or by a stream. I don't want to be away from water again. We were relieved. We would go back to artillery. The soldiers had was up there. They didn't have water. See, we carried canteens on our pistol belt. That had played out. From then on, I wore two. Well, the captain and I, he was a West Pointer, such a nice man. We started back, and there was two guys in the group. They went on ahead. They knew where some water was down a stream. We had to wade across to get, they'd pick us up with jeeps and take us back to the position. He passed out, and it was like mesquite bushes. I don't know what kind of trees they were. They were not big. It wasn't a forest. It was like head high or less. And there was a trail way through it. Well, I knew them Japs was everywhere. And you don't usually don't see them till it's too late. And I couldn't get him up. I said, Captain, you got to get up. I grabbed hold of him, and he's not even supposed to touch an officer. I got him up. We made it on down there where the boys were, and they had cut bamboos, stick it out the ground, the cliff, and that water was running out. They were filling up their canteen. I thought I was going to have to attack them. You don't know what it is when your mouth swells up. You haven't had water. It's hell.
And you've lived it. In conclusion here, do you think that people today understand what happened in World War II? And if not, what do you want them to understand based on what you witnessed and what you experienced?
The Lord saved my life. I don't know any other reason. They don't understand. Rodney wasn't even born. He knew me as another reason for life, as a daddy and son. That movie he made is one of the best ways to get your attention. I think he's done a wonderful job there.
And he called that movie Flag of My Father, and he talked about the funeral scene. But when you see the American flag, when you go to a Louisiana Tech basketball game and they do the invocation and then the national anthem and you're looking up at that big red, white, and blue, what does that mean to you to see the Stars and Stripes?
It means everything. That's what we salute, and I can't see it pass by without saluting. It's freedom. I was asked one time, what does the red stripes mean? It's like blood. It's costly to have freedom.
Well, you know it because you lived it. I just want to thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us those stories. I know it's not easy to go back to some of those places, and I appreciate you doing that.
And I appreciate you.
That's 89-year-old Asa Ray of Monroe, Louisiana. We're out of time today, but I do have more of Asa's stories on our podcast at kmjnow.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
With binoculars, well, you can see the tracers when we're trying to take a hill. The infantry would have a 50 caliber machine gun set up, and I would be looking, and I'd direct him and tell him where the last of the tracers were, and I would shoot towards the cave. But one night I found out later that they'd be on the hillside facing us. The hole that we could see was where they could walk in. The one that the gun was in, it went back as a U, and over to the left, the one that I remember, where they took it one night, and we slept in it, and the machine gun would be set up that they were firing at us. They didn't use tracers, so you couldn't determine the tested, and their machine guns were very rapid. And this would be like 1,500 yards away, and you couldn't see that little hole. There's something interesting about that hole you might want to hear. We slept in there, the officer and two of us. We just got down to where they didn't take it, too many people along with us. And I was around pretty close to that machine gun hole. And I could hear the instrument was right around the corner because it was a hillside and they were up towards the ridge top. And the Japanese were attacking them and they'd shoot and bumble around. Well, now daylight came, there was 13 dead Japs. And the boy that was alive, there was two of them in there, killed one of them. But the boy was alive. He wouldn't have been 20 years old. He's just a kid like me. And he said his hand had a hole in it. He said he shot me in the hand. But I saw that sword lying on the ground just past him. I had a 90. He jobbed him. He said I kicked him off and shot him and killed him. 13 dead soldiers there, the enemy. And he was breathing out the lung side of his chest. The medics told him, you know what this means. And he just wanted to tell it. And he said, I know. But every now and then I'd see blood squirt out that side of his chest. I knew he was dying, and the medics took him home pretty quick. But he said they just kept coming. We kept shooting, and he said the last one was the one he killed there. And you could see them. You wouldn't get around to scout them out, but you knew they were there. You'd peep around and see the uniforms. Their bodies would be lying on the ground. And some of them was in a foxhole as big as this, as big as this tabletop here. And the direction they were coming from the other side of the ridge, it was a ridge top. And they'd come over there and charge them. They knew where that cave was. So you don't have to use any much imagination to know where they were heading. And if they had to kill 13 of them, I wouldn't be here talking to you.
And he's one of the guys that, like you said, the real heroes didn't come home. It sounds like he didn't come home, but he saved your life.
Yes. Yes, you never forget that.
You're so far away from home. Did you ever get mail from home? How often did you think of your family?
Well, the mail would come, and I don't remember what sequences, but I do remember a mail clerk. He was in the hole with me when we had made an invasion. And we were just in a few hundred yards, and we were going through a terrible attack one night, artillery war. And there was a unit behind us. They were not Army. They were Coast Guards. They were shooting long-tom guns over our head. And this shooting, it was a zigzag pace, I think it was, as you call it. Marines were giving us, the troops up there were under attack, and they was trying to support them. And this mail clerk, he was a small fella like me, and there was lagoons, the tide would push water up. And we had in a manhole. I was on one end, he was on the other. And he was going out of his head. The morning came when he got discharged. He couldn't stand it. It's just that bad. But he jumped and grabbed me, and he hollered, "Jap." And I turned, and I won't call the sergeant's name, but a friend of mine was standing as close to me as you are. And he wasn't tall, and I shot expert. I was hair trigger on it. I turned that gun to his chest. He says, "You got any mosquito lotion?" We didn't say another word. Morning came. I said, "Thank you. Thank you for speaking." I would have probably gone off deep in if I'd have killed him. That's just happening all the time. A lot of times they'd kill their buddy. He might be going to use the bathroom in combat. You just didn't want to do it right there. I know instrument was he was standing up the next morning. He was under terrible shock. He had killed his buddy that night. And you get so many days of that until you just don't know when you said mail. We wouldn't get any mail up there until we got back to the unit or the assistant foreign observer. I was just hoping and praying that I would get home. And I did. Not a scratch.